Chapter 4. Unity of the Human Race. There is still another question which science has forced on theology, in relation to man, which cannot be overlooked. Have all mankind had a common origin? And have they a common nature? Are they all descended from one pair, and do they constitute one species? These questions are answered affirmatively in the Bible and by the Church Universal. They are answered in the negative by a large and increasing class of scientific men. As the unity of the race is not only asserted in the scriptures but also assumed in all they teach concerning the apostasy and redemption of man, it is a point about which the mind of the theologian should be intelligently convinced. As a mere theologian, he may be authorized to rest satisfied with the declarations of the Bible. But as a defender of the faith, he should be able to give an answer to those who oppose themselves. There are two points involved in this question: community of origin, and unity of species. All plants and animals derived by propagation from the same original stock are of the same species, but those of the same species need not be derived from a common stock. If God saw fit at the beginning, or at any time since, to create plants or animals of the same kind in large numbers and in different parts of the earth, they would be of the same species or kind, though not of the same origin. The oaks of America and those of Europe are identical in species, even although not derived from one and the same parent oak. It may be admitted that the great majority of plants and animals were originally produced not singly or in pairs, but in groups, the earth bringing forth a multitude of individuals of the same kind. It is therefore in itself possible that all men may be of the same species, although not all descended from Adam. And such is the opinion of some distinguished naturalists. The scriptural doctrine, however, concerning man is, that the race is not only the same in kind but the same in origin. They are all the children of a common parent, and have a common nature. Section 1. Meaning of the word, or the idea of species. It is obviously essential to any intelligent answer to the question whether all the varieties of men are of one species, that we should be able to tell what a species is. This is a point of very great difficulty. Naturalists not only differ in their definitions of the term, but they differ greatly in classification. Some assume a spot on the wing of a butterfly, or a slight diversity of plumage in a bird, as proof of difference of species. Some therefore divide into 6 or 8 species what others comprehend in one. Nothing therefore can be done until men come to a common understanding on this subject, and the true idea of species be determined and authenticated. General characteristics of species. Before considering the various definitions of the term, it is proper to remark that there are certain characteristics of species which at least, until of late, have been generally recognized and admitted. 1. Originality, that is, they owe their existence and character to immediate creation. They are not produced by physical causes, nor are they ever derived from other genera or species. They are original forms. This is admitted by naturalists of all classes. Such is the doctrine of Gvir, Agassiz, Dr. Morton, and of those who hold that the varieties of the human race are so many distinct species. They mean by this that they have different origins, and are not all derived from a common stock. Every species, therefore, by general consent, has had a single origin. 2. Universality, that is, all the individuals and varieties belonging to the same species have all its essential characteristics. Wherever you find the teeth of a carnivorous animal, you find a stomach able to digest animal food, and claws adapted to seize and hold prey. Wherever you find fins to effect motion in water, you find a breathing apparatus suited to the same element. The species is transmitted whole and entire. It is the same in all individuals belonging to it, and in that sense universal. 3. Immutability, or permanence. By this is meant, first, that one species is never lost or merged in another. And secondly, that two or more species never combine so as to produce a third. The rose cannot be merged into the tulip. Nor can the rose and tulip be made to produce a new species, which is neither the one nor the other. The only permanent transmissible forms of organic life are such as constitute distinct species. Immutability, therefore, or the power to perpetuate itself, is one of the indispensable characteristics of species. This, until recently, has been the universally admitted doctrine of naturalists. And notwithstanding the efforts of the advocates of the different theories of development, it still remains the general faith of the scientific world. The leading arguments in support of this doctrine have already been adverted to when speaking of the theory of Mr. Darwin on the origin of species. Those arguments are briefly the following. 1. The historical fact that all known species of plants and animals are now precisely what they were as far back as history reaches. The Bible and the records on the Egyptian monuments carry us back to a point thousands of years before the birth of Christ. During this whole period of 5 or 6 thousand years, species have remained the same. 2. If we are to receive the facts of geology as authenticated, it is clear that the same permanence has existed from the very beginning of life on our globe. As long as any species exists at all, it exists unchanged in all that is essential to it. 3. There is an entire and acknowledged absence of all evidence of transmutation. None of the transition points or links of connection between one species and another is anywhere discoverable. 4. If species were not thus immutable, the animal and vegetable world, instead of presenting the beautiful order everywhere visible, would exhibit a perfect chaos of all organic life. 5. Notwithstanding the ingenious and long-continued efforts to render hybrids prolific, such attempts have uniformly failed. The two greatest living authorities on the subject are Dr. Bachman of Charleston, South Carolina, and M. Florenz of the Jardin des Plantes in Paris. Either hybrids, says the latter, born of the union of two distinct species, unite and soon become sterile, or they unite with one of the parent stocks and soon return to this type. They in no case give what may be called a new species, that is to say, an intermediate durable species. Les espèces ne s'altèrent point, ne changent point, ne passent point de l'une l'autre. Les espèces sont fixes. 101. There is no natural law better authenticated or more generally admitted than that species are immutable and capable of indefinite propagation. Definitions of species. No group of animals therefore can be regarded as a distinct species which has not existed as distinct from the beginning, and which is not immutable in its essential characteristics, and which is not capable of propagating itself indefinitely. These are important landmarks, but they are not sufficient to guide us in all cases to a satisfactory conclusion as to whether given individuals or varieties are of the same or of different species. 1. Because the origin of these varieties cannot be historically traced. The Caucasian and the Negro have existed with their present distinguishing characteristics for several thousands of years. But this does not prove that they differed from the beginning. 2. Because certain varieties of the same species, when once established, become permanent and are capable of indefinite continuance. Several varieties of dogs depicted on the Egyptian monuments centuries before Christ are precisely what now exist. Naturalists therefore have sought for some precise definition of species, although these attempts have not been generally successful. Gvir says we are under the necessity of admitting the existence of certain forms which have perpetuated themselves from the beginning of the world, without exceeding the limits first prescribed. All the individuals belonging to one of these forms constitute what is termed a species. De Candolle says we write under the designation of species all those individuals who mutually bear such close resemblance to each other as admits of our supposing they have arisen from a single pair. Agassiz 102 says species is founded upon less important distinctions, such as color, size, proportions, sculpture, etc. The objections to these definitions are, 1. That they do not enable us to distinguish between species and varieties. 2. They refer almost exclusively to what is external or material, color, size, proportion, etc., as the criteria, to the neglect of the higher constituents of the animal. Dr. Pritchard says that under the term species are included all those animals which are supposed to have arisen in the first instance from a single pair. And to the same effect, Dr. Carpenter says, when it can be shown that two races have had a separate origin, they are regarded as of different species. And, in the absence of proof. This is inferred when we find some peculiarity of organization characteristic of each, so constantly transmitted from parent to offspring, that the one cannot be supposed to have lost, or the other to have acquired it, through any known operation of physical causes. The objection to this view of the matter is that it makes community of origin, either proved or inferred, the criterion of sameness of species. But, in the first place, this community of origin cannot in a multitude of cases be established. And in the case of man, it is the very thing to be proved. The great question is, are Mongolians, Africans, and Caucasians all derived from a common parent? And in the second place, although community of origin would prove identity of species, diversity of origin would not prove diversity of species. All the varieties of the horse and dog would constitute one species for each class, although they had been created as they now are. Species means kind, and if two animals are of the same kind, they are of the same species, no matter what their origin may have been. Had God created one pair of lions in Asia, another in North Africa, another in Senegal, they would all belong to one species. Their identity of kind would be precisely the same as though all were descended from one pair. Dr. Morton's definition of species as a primordial organic form has obtained general acceptance. It is, however, liable to objection on the ground of the ambiguity of the word form. If by form be understood external structure, the definition is unsatisfactory. If we understand the word in its scholastic sense of essential and formative principle, it amounts to the same thing which is more distinctly expressed in other terms. Agassiz gives another and much more satisfactory idea of the nature of species, when he refers to an immaterial principle as its essential element, and that to which the sameness of the individuals and varieties embraced within it is to be referred. 103 He says, besides the distinctions to be derived from the varied structure of organs, there are others less subject to rigid analysis, but no less decisive, to be drawn from the immaterial principle, with which every animal is endowed. It is this which determines the constancy of species from generation to generation, and which is the source of all the varied exhibitions of instinct and intelligence which we see displayed, from the simple impulse to receive the food which is brought within their reach, as observed in the polyps, through the higher manifestations, in the cunning fox, the sagacious elephant, the faithful dog, and the exalted intellect of man, which is capable of indefinite expansion. Again, he says 104 the constancy of species is a phenomenon dependent on the immaterial nature. All animals, he says, may be traced back in the embryo to a mere point upon the yolk of an egg, bearing no resemblance whatever to the future animal. But even here an immaterial principle which no external influence can prevent or modify, is present, and determines its future form. So that the egg of a hen can produce only a chicken, and the egg of a codfish only a cod. Professor Dana says 105 the units of the inorganic world are the weight elements and their definite compounds or their molecules. The units of the organic are species, which exhibit themselves in their simplest condition in the germ cell state. The kingdoms of life in all their magnificent proportions are made from these units. Again, 106, when individuals multiply from generation to generation, it is but a repetition of the primordial type idea. And the true notion of the species is not in the resulting group, but in the idea or potential element which is at the basis of every individual of the group. Here we reach solid ground. Unity of species does not consist in unity or sameness of organic structure, in sameness as to size, color, or anything merely external. But in the sameness of the immaterial principle, or potential idea, which constitutes and determines the sameness of nature. In the initial point on the yolk of the egg, there is no difference of form, no difference discernible by the microscope, or discoverable by chemical analysis, between one germ and another, between the initial cell of the bird and that of the fish. And yet the whole difference is there. The difference, therefore, cannot exist in what is external, although within certain limits and in further development it is manifested externally, but in what is immaterial. So that where the immaterial principle of Agassiz, or the potential idea of Dana, is the same, the species is the same. Where the immaterial principle is different, the species is different. Section 2. Evidence of identity of species. Such being the case, the only question is, how can we determine whether the immaterial principle which constitutes and determines the species be the same or different? Aside from divine revelation, this can be ascertained 1. partly from the organic structure. 2. Partly from the physis, or physical nature. 3. Partly from the psych, or psychological nature. 4. Partly from permanence and capability of indefinite propagation. Organic structure. The first evidence of the identity of species is to be sought in the asma, or the organic structure. The evidence of design is impressed on all the organized bodies in the universe, and especially upon the bodies of all animals. Those intended to live on the dry ground, those intended to live in water, and those intended to fly in the air, have their animal frame adapted to these severe modes or conditions of existence. There is also clear evidence of the unity of this design. That is, it is carried out in all parts of the bodily organization. Those animals intended to live on dry ground have none of the structure, or organs, or members peculiarly suited to aquatic animals. The lion, tiger, ox, horse, etc., have neither the gills, the scales, the fins, nor the rudder-like tail of the fish. All parts of the animal harmonize. They are all related and adapted to one and the same end. The body of the fish is shaped so as to cleave the water with the least resistance. Its fins are oars, its tail is adapted both for propulsion and guidance. Its breathing apparatus is suited to separate the air from water. Its digestive organs are adapted to the assimilation of the kind of food furnished by the element in which it lives. The same thing is obviously true of all terrestrial animals. Besides this general adaptation of animals for living in the air, in the water, and on the dry ground, there are innumerable more specific adaptations suiting the species of fishes, birds, and land animals for the particular modes of life for which they are designed. Some are intended to be carnivorous, and their bodies are harmoniously constructed with a view to that end. Others are intended to live on herbs, and in them we find everything adapted for that purpose. This adaptation refers to numerous and varied purposes. Hence the genera and the species of animals belonging to the different departments, classes, orders, and families into which the animal kingdom is divided, are exceedingly numerous, and each has its distinctive corporeal organization indicative of the specific end it is intended to subserve. So minute, and so fixed is the plan on which each species of animal is constructed, that a skillful naturalist, from the examination of a single bone, can tell not only the family, or genus, but the very species to which it belongs. Agassiz has, from a single scale of a fish, delineated its whole body as accurately as though the living animal had been photographed. And the correctness of his delineation has been afterwards verified by the discovery of a perfect specimen of the species portrayed. Now, the important principle deducible from these admitted facts is, that no diversity of color, form, proportion, structure, etc., not indicative of design, or not proving a difference in the immaterial principle which determines the nature of the animal, can of itself be admitted as proof of diversity of species. The Italian Greyhound and the English Mastiff differ in all the respects just mentioned. The Shetland pony, the London dray horse, and the Arabian or the barb exhibit similar striking diversities. But when they come to be anatomically examined, it is found that they are constructed on the same plan. The bony structures, the distribution of the nerves, muscles, and blood vessels, are all expressive of the same general intention. Hence, naturalists refer these varieties to the same species. And the correctness of this conclusion is confirmed by every other criterion of the identity of species. While it is admitted that such diversity as do exist in the varieties belonging to the same species of the lower animals, it is surprising that far less diversity is of the same kind among the varieties of the human family should be insisted upon, as evidence of difference of species. The wild dog wherever found is nearly of the same color, and the same size, with ears, limbs and tail of the same form, and yet how endless are the permanent varieties derived from that original stock. It is well known that such varieties can be artificially produced. By skillful breeding, almost any peculiarity of form, color, or structure within the limits of the original idea of the species can be produced and perpetuated. As is seen in the different breeds of horses, cattle, and sheep found even in so restricted a field of operation as Great Britain. It is certain, therefore, that no diversity of an external or material character, not indicative of diversity of design, plan, and intention can properly be assumed as indicative of diversity of species. The presence of a skin connecting the toes or claws of a bird is in itself a comparatively small affair. It is insignificant as to the amount of material expended, and as to the effect on the general appearance compared to the points of difference between the greyhound and the mastiff, and yet it is indicative of design. It indicates that the animal is intended to live in the water, and everything else in its structure and nature is found to correspond with that intention. A small difference of structure indicative of design will prove difference of species, when much greater differences not thus indicative are perfectly consistent with unity of species. Physiological argument. The second method of determining the identity of the immaterial principle in which the idea of species resides is the examination of its fusus, or its physiology. To this department belongs all that relates to innervation or the distribution of the nerve power, to the circulation of the blood, to respiration, to calorification or production of animal heat, to the distribution of the muscles voluntary and involuntary, to the processes of digestion, assimilation, propagation, etc., etc. As to this point it is to be observed, 1. That the fusus, or animal nature, is always in accordance with the esma, or corporeal structure. We never find the organs of an aquatic animal with the fusus of a land animal. Everything relating to the physiology of the animal is in harmony with its corporeal organization. 2. That where in all respects the physical nature of individuals or varieties is the same, there the species is the same. Where the fusus is different, the species is different. 3. That the physiology of an animal is thus as easily ascertained, and is just as uniform and fixed, as its material structure, and in fact much more so. The material structure may, and as we have seen does, differ exceedingly in the different varieties included under the same species, but the fusus is always the same. The physiology of the greyhound is identical with that of the mastiff, and that of the Shetland pony is the same as that of the London dray horse. Psychological argument. The third criterion of the identity of species is to be sought in the psuch, or the psychological nature of the animal. The psuch is the immaterial principle which belongs to all animals, and is the same in kind in every distinct species. It is that in which the life resides, which is the seat of the instincts, and of that measure of intelligence, be it greater or less, which belongs to the animal. The psuch is the same in all the individuals of the same species, and it is permanent. The instincts and habits of the bee, the wasp, the ant, and the beaver. Of the lion, tiger, wolf, fox, horse, dog, and ox. And of all the endless diversity as of beasts, birds, fishes, and insects, are the same in all ages and in all parts of the world. This immaterial principle is of a higher order in some cases than in others, and admits of greater or less degrees of culture, as seen in the trained elephant or well-disciplined pointer. But the main thing is that each species has its own psuch, and that this is a higher element and more decisive evidence of identity than the corporeal structure or even the fusus, or animal nature. Where these three criteria concur, where the corporeal organization, and everything indicative of design, is the same. Where the fusus and the psuch, the physical and psychological natures, are the same, there, beyond all reasonable doubt, the species is the same. The fourth criterion of species is found not only in its permanence but in the capacity of procreation and indefinite propagation which belongs to all the individuals and varieties which it includes. Animals of the same species can propagate their kind. Animals of different species cannot combine and perpetuate a new or mongrel species. This, as we have seen, is an admitted fact among all classes of naturalists, a few individuals excepted. It is a fact patent to all mankind and verified by the experience of all ages. Section 3. Application of these criteria to man. When we come to apply these several criteria to the human race, it is found beyond dispute that they all concur in proving that the whole human family are of one and the same species. In the first place, the corporeal frame or external structure is the same in all the varieties of the race. There is the same number of bones in the skeleton. Their arrangement and disposition are the same. There is the same distribution of the blood vessels. The brain, The spinal marrow and the nervous system are the same in all. They all have the same muscles amounting to many thousand in number. The organs for breathing, respiration, digestion, secretion, and assimilation are the same in all. There are indeed indefinite diversities in size, complexion, and character, and color of the hair, within the same variety of the race, and between the varieties themselves. Some of these diversities are variable, and some are fixed. The Caucasian, the Mongolian, the African, have each their peculiarities by which the one is easily distinguished from the other, and which descend from generation to generation without alteration. With regard to these peculiarities, however, it is to be remarked, first, that they are less important and less conspicuous than those which distinguish the different varieties of domestic animals all belonging to the same species. No two men, or no men of different races, differed from each other so much as the little Italian greyhound and the powerful mastiff or bulldog. And secondly, none of these peculiarities are indicative of difference of design or plan, and therefore they are not indicative of difference in the immaterial principle, which according to the naturalists of the highest class, determines the identity of species and secures its permanence. And thirdly, these peculiarities are all referable to the differences of climate, diet, and mode of life, and to the effect of propagation in case of acquired peculiarities. The truth of this last statement as to the influence of these several causes in modifying and perpetuating varieties in the same species is abundantly illustrated and confirmed in the case of all the lower animals. Such is the sameness of all the varieties of mankind as to their corporeal structure, that a system of anatomy written in Europe and founded on the examination of the bodies of Europeans exclusively would be as applicable in Asia, Africa, America, and Australia, as in Europe itself. The second criterion of sameness of species is to be sought in the physis, or physical nature. In this respect also all mankind are found to agree, so that the physiology of the Caucasian, Mongolian, and African is precisely the same. The laws which regulate the vital processes are the same in all. Respiration, digestion, secretion, and propagation are all conducted in the same way in every variety of the species. The third criterion is found in the psychic or psychological nature. This, as we have seen, is the highest test, for the psychic or immaterial principle is the most important element in the constitution of every living creature. Where that is the same, the species is the same. There can be no reasonable doubt that the souls of all men are essentially the same. They not only have in common all the appetites, instincts, and passions, which belong to the souls of the lower animals, but they all share in those higher attributes which belong exclusively to man. They all are endowed with reason, conscience, and free agency. They all have the same constitutional principles and affections. They all stand in the same relation to God as spirits possessing a moral and religious nature. The fourth criterion is permanence, and the ability of indefinite propagation. We have seen that it is a law of nature, recognized by all naturalists with a few recent exceptions, that animals of different species do not cohabit and cannot propagate. Where the species are nearly allied, as the horse and the ass, they may produce offspring combining the peculiarities of both parents. But there the process stops. Mules cannot continue the mongrel race. It is, however, an admitted fact that men of every race, Caucasian, Mongolian, and African, can thus cohabit, and their offspring can be indefinitely propagated and combined. Were these units species, says Professor Dana, 107 capable of blending with one another indefinitely, they would no longer be units, and species could not be recognized. The system of life would be a maze of complexities. And whatever its grandeur to a being that could comprehend the infinite, it would be an intelligible chaos to man. It would be to man the temple of nature fused over its whole surface, and through its structure, without a line the mind could measure or comprehend. As therefore the universe is constructed on a definite plan, as its laws are uniform, and as the constituent elements of the material world are permanent, it would be in strange contradiction with this universal analogy, if in the highest department of nature, in the organic and living world, everything should be unstable, so that species could mingle with species, and chaos take the place of order and uniformity. As therefore the different varieties of men freely unite and produce offspring permanently prolific, all those varieties must belong to one and the same species, or one of the most fixed of the laws of nature, is in their case reversed. The evidence of identity of race cumulative. It is to be observed that the strength of this argument for the unity of the human race does not depend upon any one of the above mentioned particulars separately. It is rather in their combination that the power of the argument lies. It is not simply because the corporeal structure is essentially the same in all men, nor simply because they have all the same physical or the same psychological nature, or that they are capable of producing permanently prolific offspring, but because all these particulars are true in respect to the whole human family wherever found and through the whole course of its history. It becomes a mere matter of logomachy to dispute whether men are of the same species, if they have the same material organism, the same fuscus and the same such. Whether of the same species or not, if these things be admitted which cannot be rationally denied, they are of the same nature, they are beings of the same kind. Naturalists may give what meaning they please to the word species. This cannot alter the facts of the case. All men are of the same blood, of the same race, of the same order of creation. That the races of men, says Delitzsch, are not species of one genus, but varieties of one species, is confirmed by the agreement in the psychological and pathological phenomena in them all, by similarity in the anatomical structure, in the fundamental powers and traits of the mind, in the limits to the duration of life, in the normal temperature of the body and the average rate of pulsation, in the duration of pregnancy, and in the unrestricted fruitfulness of marriages between the various races. 108. Section 4. Philological and Moral Evidence. Besides the arguments above mentioned, which are all of a zoological character, there are others, not less conclusive, of a different kind. It is one of the infelicities which has attended this controversy, that it has been left too much in the hands of naturalists, of men trained to the consideration almost exclusively of what is material, or at most of what falls within the department of natural life. They thus become one-sided, and fail to take in all the aspects of the case, or to estimate duly all the data which enter into the solution of the problem. Thus Agassiz ignores all the facts connected with the languages, with the history, and with the mental, moral, and religious character and condition of man. He therefore comes to conclusions which a due consideration of those data would have rendered impossible. The science of comparative philology is founded on laws which are as certain and as authoritative as the laws of nature. Language is not a fortuitous production. It is essentially different from instinctive cries, or inarticulate sounds. It is a production of the mind, exceedingly complex and subtle. It is impossible that races, entirely distinct, should have the same language. It is absolutely certain from the character of the French, Spanish, and Italian languages that those nations are, in large measure, the common descendants of the Latin race. When therefore it can be shown that the languages of different races or varieties of men are radically the same, or derived from a common stock, it is impossible rationally to doubt their descent from a common ancestry. Unity of language, therefore, proves unity of species because it proves unity of origin. Diversity of language, however, does not prove diversity either of species or of origin, because that diversity may be otherwise accounted for, as by the confusion of tongues at Babel, or by the early and long-continued separation of different tribes. The point, however, now to be urged, is this. Such naturalists as Agassiz, on merely zoological principles, have decided that it is more probable not that it is necessary or certain, but simply that it is more probable that the different varieties of men, even down to different nations, have had different origins, and as Agassiz in his later writings maintains, are of different species. When, in many cases at least, it is absolutely certain, from the character of the languages which they speak, that they must have been derived from a common stock. Agassiz and others represent the Asiatic and European races as distinct in origin and species. But Alexander von Humboldt says, the comparative study of languages shows us that races now separated by vast tracts of land are allied together and have migrated from one common primitive seat, The largest field for such investigations into the ancient condition of language, and consequently into the period when the whole family of mankind was, in the strict sense of the word, to be regarded as one living whole, presents itself to the long chain of Indo-Germanic languages, extending from the Ganges to the Iberian extremity of Europe, and from Sicily to the North Cape. 109 Max Emler says, "The evidence of language is irrefragable, and it is the only evidence worth listening to. With regard to anti-historical periods, there is not an English jury nowadays, which, after examining the hoary documents of language, would reject the claim of a common descent in a legitimate relationship between Indo, Greek, and Teuton." 110 The Chevalier Bunsen says, "The Egyptian language attests an unity of blood with the great Aramaic tribes of Asia, whose languages have been comprised under the general expression of Semitic, of the languages of the family of Shem. It is equally connected by identity of origin with those still more numerous and illustrious tribes which occupy now the greatest part of Europe, and may, perhaps, alone or with other families, have a right to be called the family of Japhet." 111 This family, he says, includes the German nation, the Greeks and Romans, and the Indians and Persians. Two-thirds of the human race are thus identified by these two classes of languages which have had a common origin. By the same infallible test, Bunsen shows that the Asiatic origin of all the North American Indians is as fully proved as the unity of family among themselves. 112 Every day is adding some new language to this affiliated list, and furnishing additional evidence of the unity of mankind. The particular point to be now considered is that the conclusions of the mere zoologist as to the diversity of species and consequent diversity of origin of the different varieties of our race are proved to be false by the certain testimony of the common origin of the languages which they speak. The spiritual relationship of men. Besides the arguments already mentioned in favor of the unity of mankind, next to the direct assertion of the Bible, that which after all has the greatest force is the one derived from the present condition of our moral and spiritual nature. Wherever we meet a man, no matter of what name or nation, we not only find that he has the same nature with ourselves, that he has the same organs, the same senses, the same instincts, the same feelings, the same faculties, the same understanding, will, and conscience, and the same capacity for religious culture, but that he has the same guilty and polluted nature, and needs the same redemption. Christ died for all men, and we are commanded to preach the gospel to every creature under heaven. Accordingly, nowhere on the face of the earth are men to be found who do not need the gospel or who are not capable of becoming partakers of the blessings which it offers. The spiritual relationship of men, their common apostasy, and their common interest in the redemption of Christ, demonstrate their common nature and their common origin beyond the possibility of reasonable or excusable doubt. Our attention has thus far been directed specially to the unity of mankind in species. Little need, he said in conclusion, as to their unity of origin. 1. Because in the opinion of the most distinguished naturalists, unity of species is itself decisive proof of the unity of origin. 2. Because even if this he denied, it is nevertheless universally admitted that when the species is the same, the origin may be the same. If mankind differ as to species, they cannot be descended from a common parent, but if identical in species, there is no difficulty in admitting their common descent. It is indeed principally for the sake of disproving the scriptural statement that all men are the children of Adam, and to break up the common brotherhood of man, that diversity of species is insisted upon. If therefore the latter be admitted, the former may be easily conceded. 3. The common origin of the languages of the vast majority of men proves, as we have seen, their community of origin, and as an inference their unity as to species. And as this community of origin is proved as to races which the mere zoologist is disposed with the greatest confidence to represent as distinct, the insufficiency of the grounds of their classification is thereby demonstrated. 4. It is, however, the direct testimony of the scriptures on the subject, with which all known facts are consistent, and the common apostasy of the race, and their common need of redemption, which render it certain to all who believe the Bible or the testimony of their own consciousness as to the universal sinfulness of humanity, that all men are the descendants of one fallen progenitor.